The Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS. Visit PCGS.com to find an authorized coin or banknote dealer near you.
All right. Hi, everybody. This is Coin Week editor Charles Morgan. And today for the Coin Week podcast, I have a guest, Nicholas Bruyer, who's recently published a book titled U.S. Treasury Notes, 1812 to 1865, An Illustrated History, which we had the courtesy from Stax Bowers to review it before it is actually hits print. Nicholas will be at the ANA in Pittsburgh. If you are attending, and he will have physical copies of the book on hand, which he'll be signing. I read the book with great interest. I find that U.S. paper money is a very complex subject that maybe isn't as often as it should be described or detailed in a linear way. This is how we come to understand coins in a very linear way, with dating and things like that. Paper money is a little bit more opaque. I found Nick's book to be pretty interesting, not only in the sense that it answered some questions that I had concerning the issuance of federal currency before the greenback, but it also answered some questions that I had after I read Don Kagan's monograph on the currency issues released around the War of the 1812. So thank you, Nick, for joining us. Let's have a wide-ranging conversation about what drove you into this. I know that you're a very versatile collector. You have experience in world coins, U.S. Postage notes, and a very major collection of that. But what drove you to this particular subject, and what is it about currency that really appeals to you?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all, Charles. And I'll start by talking about one of the great auctions that took place in the last 5 years, which was the Joel Anderson collection of paper money, which was sold by Stax Bowers in 2018. And there were notes in that collection that are excessively rare, extremely desirable. And so I was very interested in it. I was looking forward to bidding. And as I began to research notes that were going to appear in the auction, I came upon a $50 note from 1861. There was a $50 treasury note issued and an interest-bearing note, a 6% note with a two-year duration. And as I began to dig into the reference books on this, I couldn't really find out much information about it. So it was a mystery. And as I began to dig into it, well, one of the major things I discovered was that although the reference works were telling me that this note was sold to investors, this particular note was issued by the Treasury Department to a soldier in the Iowa infantry. So it was completely at odds with what I had read about Treasury notes. Here was a note being issued for use as money, and these notes were actually used to buy supplies, uniforms, food, you name it, during the Civil War. So I started to dig deeper once I had this little tidbit of knowledge. And that took me into the whole era of treasury notes, beginning with the War of 1812 and going all the way through the end of the Civil War. And what I found was that treasury notes had really acted as a de facto paper currency for the United States for many times when it needed a national currency. And this usually happened during some of the most dangerous times in American history, the War of 1812, the war with Mexico, major financial panics, such as the Panic of 1837, the Panic of 1857, and of course, the Civil War itself. So what I discovered was that all of this, of course, it all predated the legal tender notes, which didn't come out until 1862.
You know, I was at the Joel Anderson sale myself, and I don't know if you had a chance to take in the video I put up from the first session There's some very major notes that were, that went down in that that sale, and one of the things that struck me about the I guess Joel's collection, not only the breadth of it and the quality of the notes, is just how complex a tapestry I think U.S. paper money is, and I think about how, you know, it seems like, so I'm a Gen X collector, and if you imagine that I come into the hobby after the clad era takes hold, yeah. And there's a lot of bias, I think, in collecting, where after silver is taken out of circulation, those aren't real coins anymore. Right. So there's a little bit of like this urge to like support the metal over the fiat money, right? But yes. If you really think about it, metalism failed the country time and time again over its history. And if it were not for the paper currency being issued at these like emergency points, if it wasn't for like JP Morgan bailing out the treasury when it had depleted its gold supplies, if it wasn't for the greenback, if it wasn't for a colonial currency, there really couldn't have been in the United States developing the way we have it. And even if you look at the gold standard, and how that the use of the gold standard in the industrialized world came to a head at the early 20th century, where all the major industrial countries knew they had to abandon it in order to have more a better ability to marshal their economies towards growth. It seems to me that like coin collectors have this sort of this perverse misunderstanding of the relationship between money and metal.
Yes. Well, of course, what you're highlighting is really the fundamental problem, which is that precious metals are inelastic. So in an economy, if you need to grow the money supply, you can't just suddenly conjure up more gold or conjure up more silver. And when the country's going into war and needs to procure huge amounts of supplies and pay armies and things, what it would find time and time again is that there just simply wasn't enough coinage in existence. In the middle of the Civil War, Salmon Chase, as he was constantly looking for money to fund the military against the South, he found that he could literally confiscate every single gold and silver coin in the country, and it still was not enough money to pay for the military needs of the country. So paper money played a completely different role. And of course, it continues to this day. So it's that elasticity where you can grow it or you can contract it becomes a very, very important tool in times when you're at war or if your economy is going through a recession or depression. Also, it's not true, of course, that these treasury notes, for example, in the era we're talking, were not redeemable in coin. For the most part, they were all redeemable in coin. When they matured, you could take them in and cash them in gold or in silver. So for virtually all of their history, they were exchangeable for coin, but the coin was being held for the most part in the treasury or in its designated banks. And the private banking system basically ran off of that principle. So they were issuing private bank notes left and right for the more than a half a century of our history. And if you wanted that converted into coin, you had to go into the bank and hope that there actually was coin in the vault behind that private bank note.
I think one of the things that, it was helpful to me in the book, Nick, was that I think I came at the topic with the perspective of trying to understand the federal government in the 19th century, not in the way that we may understand the federal government today. I mean, it's a broad, expansive, powerful institution. It's got a giant bureaucracy. It touches practically every facet of American life. When we think about the Federal Reserve System and the Fed chairman and how much of an impact the Fed chairman has on the health of the economy. I mean, we look at, we had like runaway inflation about a year and a half ago. The Fed decides to manipulate the money supply and do different things with the interest rate. And then all of a sudden we see that getting marshaled down. But when you go to the period of Andrew Jackson, for instance, I can't imagine that the Second Bank of the United States had anywhere near the influence over the national economy that Alan Greenspan might have had or Janet Yellen has today. And there was a sort of a you could look at the political cartoons of the day. It was almost like a life and death battle between Jackson and this bank and the tendrils that it had in the various elements of the economy. I think Jackson probably misunderstood the bank. I think it was a pretty well-run bank, but he didn't want to renew its charter. And he basically took federal deposits and put them in these pet banks and created basically a financial crisis. But when we think about this government and we think about the power of the government when it's issuing this paper money, it doesn't really have a monopoly on the currency like we think of it today. So we really have to remove that kind of bias when we're looking at the 19th century and understanding how these paper money issues in the, were issued and the expanse they, or I guess how they circulated, how, you know, and how they competed against other money.
Well, yes. In fact, I would say it's completely different from today. First of all, as you point out, there was a basic fundamental small is beautiful attitude towards government back then. And so they generally, politicians of that era, abhorred deficit spending and the national debt that was carried. There was a constant focus on reducing that debt to eliminate it. And that really began in earnest under Thomas Jefferson. He took over the government from Hamilton, who was a big government federalist, and immediately his Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, began cutting. And the government suddenly started running surpluses, and they started paying down their debts from the Revolutionary War. And that continued all the way till 1835, when the federal debt was completely paid off in full. And of course, that was during an era of the Second Bank of the United States. And that bank performed the fundamental role of providing a national circulating currency, which did not exist otherwise because the Constitution said, well, the federal government cannot issue its own paper money. So by participating in the charter of an independent bank, which now currently exists in the form of the Federal Reserve Bank, we had that independent system. The early politicians in our government were very wise in that they firmly believed that if paper money was put in the hands of politicians, it would absolutely destroy the country. And you'd certainly wonder what they would think if they could take a look at the numbers being run in terms of deficit spending and debt by the federal government today, what they would think of how things have evolved. But during this period, because they were running primarily off of a silver and gold-based monetary system, again, they suffered from that inelasticity. They had to depend on the private banks to increase the money supply, but they were largely unregulated. And, you know, people were victimized by these wildcat bankers who would go into business and suddenly go out of business and take everybody's deposits with them. I'm going to say, excuse me for just a second, I'm going to shut my door. Where my wife knows about this and she's trying to control these dogs. This is despite all good intentions. The government really didn't have its own paper money, but when it got to points where it urgently needed to pay for the expenses of the government, whether it was wartime expenses or otherwise, they could go to what were originally known as bills of credit, which became known when it was issued by the government as treasury notes. And they turned to those. And some of those notes would be sold as investments and pay an interest rate to investors. But just as often, those notes would be issued at low interest rates or even no interest rates and would be used in payment. And that started during the War of 1812, when we issued the small notes in the little denominations of $3, $5, $10, $20, and $50. And those bore no interest at all. They were exchangeable for bonds, but they could be used as cash payments by the government to pay its bills.
So let's talk real quickly about that. Like, who would you imagine were the, or did, no, let me rephrase it. Were the customers for these notes, these treasury notes, different, a different type of clientele around the War of 1812, as opposed to around the hard times around 1830 and the 1830s versus the Civil War era? Were these different institutions or customers that would be purchasing or using these notes?
For the most part, up until the Civil War, these were commercial clients. So first of all, they were creditors of the banks. If you sold goods, creditors of the federal government, if you sold supplies to the army, if you were constructing a new facility for the government, you needed to be paid. If the government did not have the coin on hand to pay, then they would pay you in treasury notes. They even at points paid government employees, including congressmen and senators, in treasury notes. That's what they received for their pay. So these were used broadly in commercial transactions in that era. It really wasn't until the Civil War when they began to really seep into use on the man on the street. And that happened in a big way with when the armies were being rapidly built. And in 1861, the Secretary of the Treasury, Chase, asked for two different kinds of treasury notes. One was a non-interest bearing treasury note called a quote unquote demand note. And that was used in low denominations, sent out to pay troops all over the country. And the second category were interest-bearing, 7.3% interest-bearing treasury notes, like the Eagle note that you were referring to. And those were sold almost entirely to investors. So you had those two classes of treasury notes. And things got even more crazy from there at the end of 1861, when there was a specie suspension. We stopped paying out, well, the banks stopped paying out gold coin. And early by, you know, February 1862, they were issuing legal, you know, so-called fiat or legal tender notes that were redeemable essentially in nothing. You could convert them into bonds, but you couldn't redeem them for coin any longer. And from there, we had a series of treasury notes, interest-bearing and otherwise. Through these periods, the banks were very interested in these treasury notes for two reasons. One is that they continued to be afraid that the government was going to push out their ability to issue their own private bank notes, which was a very profitable enterprise for the banks. They loved it. And they lived in fear that the government was going to push them out of that. The second being that banks would also take in these treasury notes and put them into their monetary reserves. They had a choice. They could keep gold coin in their vaults, which earned no interest, or they could have a treasury note that would earn interest. And so if they loaned out money, they could earn interest on their loans. They could simultaneously earn interest on the reserves in their bank vaults.
So, and how stable would you say this currency was? I mean, was it a situation because it did have as its underlining basis bimetallist system, that the dollar, as long as the dollar stayed constant, these notes sort of maintained a certain value, or did they start selling at a discount at any given time?
They were very stable. And the reason they were stable was not so much because they could be, well, it wasn't because they could be immediately converted into silver and gold, because, you know, you had to hold them to maturity, but they were redeemable almost during the entire history of treasury notes. For government obligations. So if you had taxes to pay, and 90% of government income during most of the first 50 years of our history was for customs duties. So 90% of the income roughly was for custom duties to the government. And you could use these treasury notes to pay your customs bills. So if they started to drop in value, say 2 or 3% below face value, well, the importers would buy them up and they would, you know, they would get that 1 or 2 or 3% discount, and then they could pay them to the government for their custom duties at full face value. And that buoyed up the value of treasury notes, even when the value of government bonds might be in the tank. There were periods where the government bonds were selling at 20% discount, but the treasury notes were only selling at a 2% discount.
So how difficult is this material to collect, and what would be like a good starting point or an organizational structure for somebody who isn't experienced to sort of start to think about this?
Well, the bad news is that the treasury notes are rare, and they're rare because they none of them ever became irredeemable. They were all redeemable by the government. And so you could take them in and get your money out of them, and they got cash because they were all good. There was no such thing as a repudiated obligation of the United States government. They were all honored. So because of that, they're anywhere from rare to extremely rare. The most common of them, if we can call treasury notes common, were issued during the Civil War. Right in the middle of the Civil War, in 1864, you had lower denominations such as $10 and $20 notes that the government was producing primarily for military pay. So these notes were 5% interest bearing. They were 1 year duration, and they were being sent out in large volumes for military pay. Also, the demand notes of 1861, which were heavily used for military pay, are among the, we'll call them the least rare of the treasury notes. And they can be picked up. One of the things you'll see is that they're all very well worn. And what that should tell you is that they saw heavy use. These notes were not being bought and stuck in a box somewhere. They were not being tucked under a mattress. These notes were being used and circulated as money. And that's why, for example, demand notes of 1861 are extremely rare in high grade. Most of them are very well worn because they were being used as money and passed hand to hand.
Now, of course, after the Civil War concludes, it takes the government about a decade to start to really see the impact of its efforts to get silver and gold back into circulation. But it seems to me that the Civil War was a fundamental turning point in the public's relationship with paper money, because, you know, by the time you get to the 1870s, 80s, 90s, I think the public by and large starts to prefer having the paper money as opposed to the heavy coin. Of course, they like to have the paper money backed by something, right? Gold and silver. But I think they like the convenience of it. Do you think it was because of the hoarding of coins during the Civil War and the ease of use and the proliferation of paper money that public sentiment started to switch? Or do you think it was just an inevitable thing that was going to happen?
I think that the Civil War did cause that. The paper, they became familiar with it. At first, they didn't know what to make of it. When the demand notes started showing up at local stores, when the later treasury notes in 1864 started going hand to hand, actually, it turned out the soldiers loved them because most of the soldiers, you know, they were out in the field and they had families back at home. These people were farmers. And they had families back at home that they needed to support. And a lot of this money went straight from the soldiers' hands directly to their families back home to pay the bills. And they loved the fact that they could mail these things back home. So they got a tremendous amount of use. and were highly preferred, you know, to coin if they had any coin at that time, which they largely didn't, because the gold was selling at a premium to the paper dollar. But people became quite familiar and quite comfortable with government paper money during this era. And of course, when the Union prevailed in the Civil War, you know, the bonds and the obligations of the government were literally as good as gold. There was no doubt that the backing of the notes was there. And also by that time, by the end of the Civil War, the private bank notes were essentially wiped out. Secretary Chase coveted the deposits that people had made to obtain private bank notes. He wanted the private banks to convert their reserves into U.S. Treasury bonds. And that happened. And they taxed private bank notes right out of existence. And then, of course, we had that whole era of national bank notes. So people became quite comfortable with paper money during the Civil War and preferred it for practical reasons.
I can't say I blame Chase. I mean, it seems like the private banknote issuing as a national policy seems like madness when you consider, you know, all of the abuses in the banking system, how, you know, many of these banks go bankrupt. Some of the banks are issuing paper money and not redeeming them. It just seemed like a very speculative industry, and there wasn't really a firm requirement of what background you had or what you had to do in order to set up your bank in some rural part of the frontier country.
Well, he came from the Midwest. He was an Ohio Republican, and he had seen a lot of the abuses of wildcat bankers in the Midwest, because there was a lot of it back then. And so he came to Washington with a very cynical view. On the other hand, he knew that his job was to get money to pay for the Civil War. That was fundamental. If they couldn't pay for it, they were going to lose the war, and the Union was going to be broken up, and that was the end. So he was on a constant search for money. And when he saw that, you know, the banks were holding all these assets, he naturally coveted those assets. He also found the banks could be very temperamental about loaning the government money. And very early on, he tried to launch some bond issues early in 1861, and they failed. They wanted premium interest rates, this and that. They were reluctant to loan the government money. So he turned to Treasury notes and began issuing Treasury notes. And he literally believed that he could pay for the entire Civil War using Treasury notes.
You know, one of the things that I think is really striking about this period in our currency, it seems like the government really was like experimenting quite a bit. You know, if you look at just the issue of postal currency, the fractional currency, the different series of notes that were issued by the Treasury, just a wide diversity of motifs and subjects. You know, so many of these are, maybe stock types of illustrations, but it got more and more sophisticated. And when you compare that to what we have today, of course, you know, we have much more advanced counterfeiting problems, you know, that the BEP has to address. But it does seem that we've fallen into this comfort zone of having no tangible change to monetary design. But in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, 90s, I mean, they were constantly changing currency and the design of currency. How did the general public keep up with that?
Well, I think they had a hard time keeping up with it. In fact, the Treasury itself had a hard time keeping up with it. And some of it was, you know, was driven by the public, but it was also driven by the banks. For example, in 1864, late 1863, Secretary Chase needed $150 million dollars to finance a war. How is he going to get that? Well, he decided that he needed to make a new issue of treasury notes to do that. And when he went to the banks to get, say, I want to issue these treasury notes, they said, well, you know what? We would like to have coupons on them like bonds. And he said, you know, I really don't want that. It's a pain. You know, you have to surrender the notes and get them clipped and all this stuff. And they said, but that's what we want, because when we can clip a coupon, we can get the little interest payment and reinvest it. And he went ahead and did that. And he soon learned that the problem was that every time another coupon came due every 6 months, these banks could take all the notes, the interest went to zero on them because they clipped their little coupon off the note. Suddenly the notes were face value. They could just be used like money, and they were. So all of a sudden the money supply was going up and down like a yo-yo, and Chase was seeing the inflationary effects of that. It really frightened him. And after a few months, he discontinued the coupon notes and replaced them with non-coupon notes that would just accrue interest over time. So that was one experiment that failed. And he basically said, I'm not going to issue any more coupon notes. But what he learned from that was that the bankers wanted their interest to compound so they could reinvest it. So around June of 1864, he came out with a new note called a compound interest treasury note. Said this not only will accrue interest, but it will compound. And that basically solved the coupon problem for treasury notes. And he continued to use hundreds of millions of dollars worth of those notes, which were paid out to soldiers and all kinds of things, all the way through the end of the Civil War.
So given the high face value of many of these notes, I'm often surprised that, you know, $1,000 gold certificates and things like that survive to this point, because it seems like that's an incredible amount of money to hold on to something as a collectible and not redeem it. What's your sense of, like, how did, of course, a lot of this material is rare, but what's your opinion of how this material survived? I mean, is it just they were held up in banks over time and then they really became obsolete and they were purchased by collectors? Or do you think collectors at the time started to hold on to certain things, and that's how a lot of the stuff survived?
I think they survived by accident, by and large. First of all, 99.9% at least never did survive. And a lot of these high denomination notes, you know, $500, $1,000, or $5,000, don't even exist today, except perhaps as a proof or a specimen. That were put aside during the Civil War. There were a handful of notes that were set aside for a French gentleman by the name of Vadimer, who had been building a collection for a museum in France, and the government was kind enough to give him an example of each of these types of notes. And a lot of those notes are the only examples that exist anywhere. But by and large, those high denominations were used for interbank transactions, or, you know, with investment firms, and never got into the hands of the general public at all. Weren't seen by the general public, and I think that the survival of even one of those notes is pretty much a miracle.
And because of that, it must have been very difficult for numismatists to really start to piece this all together, because, you know, if numismatics in some respects is kind of a forensic science. I mean, you know, you may not have been there during its creation, but you have the after effect of it, the object and some evidence about how it was created. So it seems that, you know, for some of this material, it really must be, you know, almost like pioneering work to try to figure it out and to write about it.
Well, that's exactly the problem I had, Charles, when I started to collect treasury notes, was the lack of information. And the reference works, when I would dig into them and try to make sense out of these different Treasury notes issues, there was a lot of missing information, and it was kind of like trying to put together a tossed salad. You get into it and say, well, what belongs to what? Or a jigsaw puzzle maybe would be a better analogy. And it was very hard to make sense out of these different issues. And some of them weren't in the reference works at all and aren't in the reference works as we speak. So my hope is that the research I've done in this book will provide a linear chronology, a linear history that people can now open at the beginning, going back to the War of 1812, and they can follow the successive issues of these Treasury notes all the way right through the end of the Civil War and see the critical role they played in the financing of the country and being really the ultimate go-to currency when all else was failing.
Well, Nick, I think you did a great job on the book. It really clarified a lot of things that I had questions about, and I'm sure I'm going to use it as a standard reference in the years to come. I look forward to seeing you at Pittsburgh, and good luck with the book and maybe finding that next great note for your collection.
Great. Thank you. I'm looking forward to see you, and hopefully everybody else will come out to the Pittsburgh convention. We are putting a display of about $1.5 million worth of rare Treasury notes. We'll be on exhibit there where I'm doing a book signing at the Stacks Bowers table.
And what day are you doing the signing?
On Thursday from 1 to 3 o'clock, and on Friday during the convention from 1 to 3 o'clock.
Well, I look forward to seeing you, Nick, and thanks for stopping by today.
Great. Thank you very much.
No problem. Have a great weekend.
You too.